Labdien, esiet sveicināti redzījumā Brīvības bulvārs. Kāpēc Kremļa vadītājs ir iesaistījis savu valsti briesmīgi navējošā karā ar nereāliem mērķiem? Kāpēc Putins uzstājīgi atsakās no termina karš un izmanto terminu vēl aizvien speciāla operācija, terminu, ko speciālie dienesti izmantoja bolševiku politiskās policijas izveides laikā 1918. Gadā? Kāda ir iemesli šim sāsinātajām revanšām pret ukraiņiem? Kā izskaidrot šādu riskantu lēmumu, kad Krievija nebija apdraudēta? Ar šādiem jautājumiem sākas šogad iznākusī franču politoloģis Marija Mendres grāmata Nebeidzamais karš – Kremļa galīgā stratēģija, ar kuru mums šoreiz arī saruna raidījumā.
The German intelligence chefs warns that Russia could be capable of attacking NATO by 2030. It was by public parliamentary hearing last week in Bundestag. Yeah. How do you see this possibility of developments of the next 6 years?
This is impossible. This is impossible. I don't understand why in our European countries, you know, intelligence or sometimes, you know, heads of government go into this new big threat. The Russian army attacking NATO, which is the one and only big political and military alliance in the world. NATO has more than half the military capacity of the whole world, and the Russian army was not even able of taking Kiev in the spring of 2022. It's now sending their men to death in eastern Ukraine just to gain, you know, a few more square kilometers with absolutely no capacity to push forward. It's a war of destruction. It's a criminal war with the intent of destroying the Ukrainian nation and the Ukrainian state. And they are failing because they never anticipated the remarkable resistance from the Ukrainians, not only the Ukrainian army, but the civilian self-defense committees that were set up everywhere in Ukraine after the annexation of Crimea 10 years ago. How could you expect this army, now made up also of conscripts, of felons from prison, and how can you expect them to attack the formidable military capacity of NATO in Europe? I mean, that makes absolutely no sense.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky this week presented long-awaited victory plan that aims to strengthen his country positions enough to end the war with Russia maybe next year. As you can see, how realistic is this Zelensky new victory plan? Because it includes also the NATO membership of Ukraine.
Volodymyr Zelensky has been forced since the very beginning of the war to push us, because we've always been late. We, the Western democracy, the allies of Ukraine, we've always been, you know, running behind the train of war. We've always been late. So every time that things get really difficult for his army and for his population under shelling, and let's not forget the terrible plight of Ukrainians under Russian occupation, which is, it cannot last, you know, it's just, so Zelensky wants to emphasize the fact that if we don't step up very, very rapidly, our support and what they, the Ukrainians, have been asking now for more than 2 years in terms of equipment, armament, technology, etc., that, you know, maybe they will not be able to continue to be this protection of Europe in terms of security. And of course, when he comes with this plan, the major precondition for victory, which in President Zelensky's mind is the withdrawal of Russian troops. Maybe a gradual withdrawal, we don't know, but it's a withdrawal of Russian troops. He knows that this withdrawal of Russian troops will not happen until the Kremlin and the military commanders in Russia understand that NATO is fully with Ukraine militarily and give the utmost security guarantee, which is membership in NATO. So this is what he is explaining, knowing very well that this is not going to happen in the next few weeks.
Within the next 2 years?
Well, there are a number of factors, you know, so we'll know better in a few weeks after the U.S. Presidential election and Congress elections. It's a very difficult time for Ukraine, but what I'd like to emphasize, and we don't talk enough about this, is that it's a very, very difficult time for the Russian army as well. There are so many cracks in the Russian army. There are cracks in, you know, the neighboring region that are now being often shelled or partly occupied, like the Kursk Oblast. And so let's look at it this way. The Russian army is not performing well, given the huge number of people that they send to fight. You know that they have much more casualties on the battlefield than the Ukrainians. And they also have a huge problem with procurement and, you know, have now to sort of get parts from North Korea that are paid by China. That, you know, the Russian army is only in capacity of continuing a war of attrition, continuing shelling, destruction. But they do not have the capacity to conquer Ukraine and rule it.
Do you see the way for Kyiv to win the war? And what exactly is the meaning of victory?
I have stopped using the terms
victory,
peace, victory, or win. Okay.
Because?
I told Ukrainian colleagues last spring that I thought it was not a good idea to call those conferences organized by Kyiv, to call them peace conferences. They are war conferences, as we held war conferences amongst allies during the Second World War in 43, 44, and 45. Though we are in war negotiations amongst ourselves, the allies, you know. We don't negotiate with Putin. Nobody can talk to Putin, not even his advisor. The man is completely locked up in his paranoia and his fears. And every time he says, well, I'm ready for peace, but I keep everything. I keep, you know, the regions that I have conquered in September 22, which is a lie, and made them subject of the Russian Federation, that is the four occupied in part, the regions occupied in part, plus Crimea and Sevastopol that are already subjects of the Russian Federation. So those, we are in the middle of a war, terrible war. We are going for war talks. And Putin, every time we make progress, he says, well, anyway, I don't want to negotiate because I don't negotiate with the Ukrainians that are paid by NATO and the US to, you know, to wage a war against us. So we live in this insane world. Russian disinformation, subversion, lies. You know, probably less in Latvia than in France. But this Russian propaganda has just been infiltrating, you know, our political space, our media.
Now, in the Western world.
Yeah, for nearly 20 years. And even after nearly 3 years of war, we are still stuck with this very perverse narrative. So, to go back to your question, the important thing is to go back to the fundamentals. This is a criminal war of aggression against nation and a state that never threatened the Federation of Russia. It is an abominable war in terms of exactions, a killing of civilians, torturing of prisoners of wars, and even sometimes killing them, of, you know, bombing infrastructures, trains. Let's go back to this. Our position, together with Ukraine, is that we must put an end to the aggression, force the Russian army to leave and withdraw and surrender in that war that they started, and then go for a negotiation with the defeated Russian army on everything, you know, how they withdraw, reparations, and then a transition period of several years where the Ukrainians, together with us, under international monitoring, will try and organize, you know, new institutions in Russia and new authorities that will be our partner in the discussions. Vladimir Putin himself, as a dictator that has decided a war that his military commanders didn't want, he is not in, I think, neither in a mental nor political capacity to negotiate anything at this stage, unless we step up our support and we take in Ukraine into a NATO as quickly as possible.
But also in war talks, as you mentioned,
yes,
there must be some diplomatic talks.
Why
anyway
are you talking of diplomacy?
You think that diplomacy is totally dead
listen,
in this moment.
Listen, you do diplomacy with a rival or a partner that is open to talks. Talks happen in this tragic situation only if there is goodwill in this. I do not see on the Kremlin side any will or capacity to make even the slightest concession, unless, you know, in the balance of forces, they are really cornered and the military commanders of Russia ask for a ceasefire. So what kind of diplomacy do you want to do when they continue to shell residential buildings in Ukraine? Plus, I'd like to add that during the first months of the aggression in 2022, the Ukrainian government agreed to talks with their Russian counterparts at a relatively high level. You remember? Huh? It went on for some 2 months, if I'm not mistaken. And then the Russians left. And actually, the Russian emissary said, well, we're sorry, but we have no instructions from the Kremlin.
But do you mean that peace is possible only with the fall of Putin?
Again, I'm no longer talking about peace or victory.
Yeah, but peace is, of course, always have been also part of the military strategies in the political science.
This war is very particular. This war is particular. If you talk of peace in a country like France or a country like Germany, you immediately have reactions from many in our political class, in our elites, and public opinion, parliamentarians say, oh, okay, well, if both are ready for peace, that's good. I mean, we've had enough of this war. So what it means is that this notion that maybe the Ukrainians should just drop the ball, you know, and say, oh, you know, we're not strong enough and we have to let Russians occupy a fifth of our territory after they have actually destroyed those territories and pushed out millions of people. This is also what needs to be stressed at this stage. You know, a war, it's not just about power and territory. It's about people, populations. And the war started in the spring of 2014. Or immediately, there was at least a million and a half of the population of Eastern Donetsk and Lugansk Oblast that had to flee, and they, to this day, are displaced people. After the invasion of February 2022, you remember how many millions of Ukrainian refugees had to, you know, seek refuge in our countries and other countries of the world, but mostly in Europe? Many of them are still there. What I mean is, Vladimir Putin has started an ordeal that cannot simply be stopped because we decide to go for some peace. Remember, very different circumstances, and certainly not such a monstrous war as today. But remember the Minsk agreements of September 14 and February 15. Everybody was sort of happy to be appeased. We should remember what appeasement mean when we know that the intentions of the aggressor are very vicious intentions. Also, you know, about what's happening in Russia. Do you know why millions of people in the Federation of Russia are in despair today? It's because they no longer understand what the war objectives were or what they are today. They are not given any peace objective. What is the kind of peace that Putin is aiming at? Because Putin has no aims for peace, and this is what we should understand. He has no interest in seeking a real peace now. So for millions of people, it's like being stuck in a tunnel and not seeing any exit from the tunnel. And that, you know, it is extremely troubling for many, many people. And we should not convey those messages of economic growth in Russia. I mean, who still, you know, takes seriously statistics coming from Moscow? Plus, if there's an economic boom, it's because it's a war economy with now huge disparities between, you know, social strata of the population, between regions and republics, between, you know, rural areas and industrial areas. So, no, but this is important.
But also war economy has some limits.
The war economy, according to my best colleagues from Russia and, you know, from France, from America, who just, of course, put aside the statistics coming from Moscow. And the war economy is already strained. The army is strained. A number of resources are depleted. This is what we should talk about on Armenia every day, instead of repeating what Putin said yesterday or, you know, all the lies. So if you take into consideration that the situation in Russia is not the sort of relatively positive macro picture that is often given in our media, but you look at the real Russia, at the very deep crisis, you stop listening to those, you know, reports and from our correspondents in Moscow or people that go to St. Petersburg that, you know, the cities are booming, that people. What we understand is that, yes, there is a lot of money in, you know, three or four very big cities of Russia. But those people, they sort of live next to the real Russia, to the war economy. You know that the people who live in St. Petersburg and Moscow, they pay not to send their men to the war. This is the kind of Russia we're facing. And I think even worse for them now, what we see, and it's based, I think, on quite a lot of evidence, testimonies, and I still communicate every day with people in Russia, and also with Russians in exile that are still very, very closely connected with people inside Russia.
Well, I think double moral could survive also 50 years, as we remember, Soviet Union.
Yeah, but it's what I'm trying to get at is we are observing very serious cracks inside the ruling elites and the dictatorship. Everybody remembers the Prigozhin sedition and how it ended. We saw Vladimir Vladimirovich terrified, just looking at him during those 2 days in June 23. He was terrified. There have been other moments in those last 3 years where he seemed to be really in fear of whether he could continue to stand there. And so there are cracks. There are cracks inside the military. There are cracks inside the new military industrial complex that have been, you know, fully revived with the war. There are cracks in the energy monopolies. This is what we should study even more. We should talk about this. We should increase sanctions. Sanctions are working because they are damaging this leadership and the groups around the leadership. Sanctions are working because they are making the men, those men who are running parts of this criminal system, we're making them more, I mean, we destabilize them. We cut them off completely from foreign economies, foreign countries, from us. They often have family abroad. And we should not underestimate the effects of the extreme isolation of Russian ruling elites, Russian middle class, that is in part a hostage of all this, you know, from Europe. Because Europe has always been, to the people that lived in the Soviet Union and now that live in Russia, Europe has always been a kind of a safe haven. You know, so there was a strong attraction to European mode of life, to, you know,
even part of society.
Everywhere in society in Soviet days, because we were more prosperous, we had a better living standards, we looked happier, and we were peaceful. We were not a threat. You see, the European nations and the EU were seen by, I would say, of course, maybe educated Soviets as the best. There was an attraction to the US, but that was very far away. But Europe was there also because, you know, Stalin has expanded his empire to European nations, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and of course the Baltic states during the Second World War. And so he had brought Europe even closer to the Soviet people, which in my view, and that's what I explain in my publications and my book of 2012, is this attraction to Europe that has been also part of the fantastic opening up under Gorbachev, the reforms, opening up to the world, to Europe, the idea of a common European home. And this is a golden period between the mid-1980s and the mid-1990s that Putin wants to erase from people's memories. But they shouldn't be erased. I mean, they demonstrate that this change inside and change to a non-confrontational stance with Western democracies was the only way out for and the best exit from Soviet isolation.
But you don't
violence.
Think that Russia will collapse or disintegrate next? What are your post-war scenarios?
Yes. So the war will end when the Russian army withdraws. Okay? There is no other possible end to the war, right? So if we start from this, it means that there is a military surrender and that there will be agreements, treaties signed where the Russian state, as it stands today, is defeated, cannot impose their conditions, right? Then the best scenario, of course, which is our scenario in Europe, is the opening of period of several years where, you know, everything is put on the table and the Russian state as it is today will stop to exist with the fall of the current group in power and the Putin system, where not only the army but the FSB and GRU special troops are also defeated and disbanded. It is very important to finally understand in Russia that as long as they keep the Czechists, the people built and ruled the Soviet Union from the 1920s until this very day, that they are disbanded, because they are the key problem that nobody really addressed, not even Gorbachev. He didn't have time to address this problem. So if we have this situation, the Federation of Russia today is in ruins. You no longer have a real parliament. You don't have justice. You don't have a real government. Do you know who is the prime minister of Russia? When I ask, nobody knows. You don't know. Okay. So there's no government, no media, no independent media, no universal suffrage. Elections are neither free nor fair. And it's been the case for many, many years. There is no opposition as an institution, as in our countries. Opposition parties are an institution. Opposition fractions in parliament are... They have no institution left. Even the presidency is no longer an institution, since Putin, in my view, is not the president of a state. He is a warrior. You know, he's a warrior, and he's doing it with clans, with industrial oligarchs and all the rest. So those ruins cannot be built on just by, you know, a defeated Russian ruling elite that will have to go. And it cannot be rebuilt by a society that is not given any means of doing so. So this reconstruction of the institutions of the state of Russia will have to be done from scratch, really. I mean, and as most of my Russian colleagues tell me, you know, it's going to be much more of a challenge than Perestroika under Gorbachev because of the destructive war. So if we look at
but
it...
But how long do you think that Russia could sustain this war?
I'd like to finish on possibility of post-war. So it's also, it's a post-war and post-Putin. It will take a few years to build sort of new administration to rule the various territories, populations, put back the economy on track, etc. So there will be monitoring from the allies or from international organizations. Then it's only after a few years that it will be possible to ask the various constituencies, the various societies that coexist in the Federation of Russia, what they actually want. So it's quite possible that a number of republics or regions, nations, do not want to keep, to be in the same state as, you know, the rest of Russia. It's possible that they might, in a completely new confederation, with security guarantees from us. Because think of the North Caucasian peoples, you know, Chechens, Ingush, Dagestani. I mean, they hate the people, you know, they hate what's going on. You know, the Kadyrov killers, this is not the Chechen people. So this, after a few years, I think we'll start having a fair idea of what people want in Russia. Before that, any opinion poll, any election will not be a serious business, because people have to feel safe before they build their own, you know, local organizations, institutions, national institutions, and come to, you know, come to a majority decision about their own fate. So I know that today it's difficult to envisage this. But one thing is sure, there will be no successor to Vladimir Putin. And that's good news.
But look, how long do you think that Russia could sustain this war? Because
I have no idea.
Russia, not Putin, yeah.
I have no idea. You know, I have no idea. We were all wrong, you know. I mean,
in predictions.
With this war. You know, we've made, it was the launch of this monstrous aggression, opening four fronts in Ukraine in February 2022. I mean, without any war aim, but just the destruction of Ukraine as such, who could have conceptualized this, you know? And then after a few weeks, they are defeated in Kyiv Oblast. you know, then things were going much better for the Ukrainian army, but the US stops funding during a very, very long winter, you know. So there are so many unknowns, so many unknowns. My conclusion, temporary conclusion, would be that there is much uncertainty on our side, but I think there might be even more uncertainty and doubt inside Russia and in the Kremlin and in you know, the high command of Russia. So they know that now they have to sort of reduce their ambitions. And that has been stated several times, like, we'll be happy if we keep, you know, the occupied regions, and we no longer want to more than that. And they, of course, pretend that they never wanted to conquer the whole of Ukraine, but just, you know, make those buffer regions safe for them. So they've already reduced this. But it's too late. Today, nobody is going to accept that deal because they have gone too far in destructions, killings, massacres. They've gone too far. So they won't get the kind of good deal they got in Minsk in 2014 and 2015. Because yes, the war started in 2014, but on a very, very different scale compared to today. And what I have been saying from the very first day of the aggression on the 24th of February 2022, let's remember that the Minsk agreement didn't work. They didn't put an end to the occupation. They didn't give more security guarantees to the Ukrainians, right? And they didn't deter Putin. So let's not go for any kind of agreement on very shaky grounds with an enemy, the current leadership of Russia, that keeps lying and that we can at no point trust.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Mendras.
Thank you very much. Mm.